No questions today.
The Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. We are just shy of a quorum, but Representative Pearson's legacy precedes him, and we will have time for those other two members to show up before he is ready for us to vote on his bill. So we will unofficially bring forward House File 1340. Representative Pearson, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
And so I shouldn't move any amendments at this point. We'll just talk about the bill in general.
Yes, sir.
All right. So this is House File 1340. I'll keep it brief, just to put Joe or the chair in a pinch for not meeting quorum on time. But probably not. And not keep it brief.
You're doing a great job of that right now. It's an appearance. Please proceed.
Stayed up too late last night watching you guys finish your committee, so it was riveting. And this bill is really addressing a pretty serious issue. You know, in my first term in 2 years ago, this was something that just came up over and over again, how there's a lack of access, how there's insufficient funding and reimbursement rates for this, and by gosh, we didn't do much about it. So that being said, we ended up, we're now ranked in first place for the lowest funding for reimbursement in the country. So out of 50 states, we are 50th in funding for pediatric care. And frankly, for adults, we don't do a whole lot better. I believe we're ranked fourth to last out of all 50 states. So we're a friendly state. We're Minnesota nice, and that should mean we should be able to smile, and we want to smile more, and we want our kids to be able to smile more. And so this bill addresses some of those systemic issues that we have that prevent that from happening. And we're really looking at increasing those rates. The cost of doing this, of course, the fiscal impacts are ranging between $100 million and $120 million. And you know, just some anecdotal understanding of what happens when people do not have access to this type of dental care, the emergency room visits alone per year, you know, if just the emergency room visits could be eliminated, that would more than pay for what this reimbursement increase would be. So with that said, you know, we certainly hope that this would be included. But with that said, I also have Dr. Denz here to address any issues or specific questions to the bill. And until we get the amendments addressed, I'll have him give you some testimony as well.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Denz. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning on this important issue. My name is Dr. Kevin Denz. I'm the president of the Minnesota Dental Association, and I'm a general dentist practicing in the Brainerd area. On behalf of dental providers across the state, I'd like to thank you for hearing our bill. As Representative Pearson indicated, Minnesota ranks 50th out of the 50 states, dead last in Minnesota medical assistance reimbursement rates for pediatric dental care, and 47th for adult dental care. The trend that we've been seeing means that it will only get worse unless something's done to lift us out of this hole that we find ourselves in. Dentists are caring people, and it's the 60% of dentists still taking medical assistance in this state with a rate that's at about 26.7% of our regular fee. That's amazing to me that dentists continue to care for these patients even while we're at a point where it's costing us money. We have to take a dollar out of our pocket to pay our staff for every patient that we see because our overhead is higher up in the 65 to 70% range, and that's not counting the dentist getting paid. So the rate increase we're asking would bring us up to about the 50th percentile among states. We're not asking to be the leader. We're just asking to bring us up from bottom. So we know that between 2003 and 2013, reimbursement rates for child dental care in Medicaid decreased 41.3% in Minnesota. And that's from information from the Health Policy Institute. we settle for this Band-Aid approach that we've done in years past, and we just keep going down this incline. We appreciate Minnesota's commitment to its health care programs for the public, but we must do more to increase access to dental care by increasing the rate. The system is at its breaking point, and access to care is failing our children and vulnerable adults when it comes to dental care. I see patients every day in my practice who have driven across the state trying to find dental care, and their dental needs are tremendous. It's not unusual for patients to drive 90 or 100 miles or more because some dentists won't see medical assistance or Minnesota care. In the Brainerd area, we have 7 offices volunteering to see emergency room patients that only need dental care when they go to the emergency room. Over 30 patients a month at Essential Hospital with just dental problems present every month in their emergency room. They're using the emergency room and usually given drugs to tide them over, adding to the already huge opioid problem. But the hospital is unable to treat the cause of their dental problem. A dentist would charge about a third of what the hospital would charge, even at their full market rate, to get the patient out of pain. Usually it's an extraction that's needed. What's more, we continue to see clinics and private practices close or limit patients, leaving our most vulnerable dental patients without a place for their dental needs. The Office of Legislative Auditor in 2013 and the Department of Human Services in both 2014 and 2015 have produced reports outlining the negative outcomes of ME enrollees due to Minnesota's low reimbursement rates for dental. One of the key findings in that 2000 OLA report was that Minnesota's fee-for-service rates for paying dentists were lower in 2012 than they were in the year 2000, and lower than the rates of other states. In addition, these rates are based on an adjustment to 1989 dentist charges and not the costs of current dental charges. The good news is we know how to fix this. House File 1340 provides the substantial rate increase that is needed to allow dentists to see these patients and take a serious step in the direction of solving our access to dental care issue. The bill also provides 2 administrative simplification measures that will greatly reduce the administrative burden on providers. Uniform credentialing and uniform prior authorization process means that providers will be able to save time and resources on the administrative side of things so that they're better able to utilize time and resources on addressing patient needs. Sometimes dentists will have a denture approved on one plan, and the next month it's half done and the patient comes in with a card from another insurer, and we have to start that process over to get pre-authorization for a denture. Otherwise, the denture isn't paid. So this approach we know has worked in other states. Research from the Health Policy Institute and other sources indicates that a substantial reimbursement rate increases paired with administrative simplification has a significant positive effect on increasing provider participation and access to dental care. For example, in 2004, the state of Georgia increased its reimbursement rate to 75% of dentist fees and saw a 550% increase in provider participation in Medicaid. Connecticut and Texas had similar results and also measured a substantial increase in preventive dental care utilization among Medicaid-eligible children, with a massive decline in unmet needs among those children. With only a third of Medicaid-eligible children and young adults in Minnesota receiving some kind of dental care last year, we stand so much to gain in creating better access and increasing utilization and provider participation. Representative Pearson's House File 1340 will change the way Minnesota delivers care and will at least put Minnesota dentists up to average among all the states. Within this increase, the Minnesota Dental Association will do all it can with our 3,000 Minnesota dentists to move the needle to have patients on public programs served with good dental care as they ought to be. Thank you for hearing this important piece of legislation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Dentz, for your testimony this morning. Dr. Helgeson?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Helgeson will address the A1 amendment, and maybe before that I'd like to do a quick oral amendment as well.
Okay. Well, since we do have quorum now, I will officially call the hearing to order. And I will move that House File 1340 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Pearson, you have the A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment, and you have an oral amendment to the A1 amendment?
Actually, the oral amendments to the main.
Okay, so we will take up the A1 amendment first. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Pearson, to your oral amendment.
Well, to my oral amendment on page 3, in paragraph that ranges between 3.13 and 3.17, there's two references to paragraph F, and we've struck F is not the denotation of that paragraph any longer. It's paragraph B. So
your oral amendment is to, on line 3.14, strike paragraph F and insert paragraph B, and on line 3.16, change the F to B in the parentheses. Strike the F and put the B. Are there any questions to the oral amendment? Mr. Chung, do we have that right?
Yes.
All right. Okay, all those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The oral amendment is adopted. Dr. Helgeson, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Michael Helgeson, the CEO and a co-founder of Apple Free Dental. And I want to thank everyone for their bipartisan support for House File 1340. As we've heard, we're experiencing a crisis in Minnesota's dental programs. Neither private dentists nor nonprofit safety net organizations can sustain services to children and vulnerable adults enrolled in Minnesota's public programs. And everyone agrees that access to dental care has been declining in the last few years, and without action now, it will continue to plummet. How are these low reimbursements and administrative barriers impacting AppleTree Dental? Our back is really up against the wall, and without this bill, thousands of our patients are already losing access to care, and that's going to get worse in the years ahead. For those of you that don't know, AppleTree is a nonprofit critical access dental provider that provides nearly 80,000 dental visits, about 90% of which are to Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollees. And we provide services at 6 urban and rural clinics and at about 130 collaborating community sites, including Head Start centers, long-term care facilities, assisted living, group homes, etc. We're known for the special care services that we deliver to people with disabilities and other complex medical conditions, and also for our services in greater Minnesota. I really want to make the urgency for action clear. We're working as hard as we can, but last year we provided nearly 2,400 fewer dental visits than the year before. Even with the grants and other support we get, we can't cover our costs. We're struggling to retain our staff, and it's having a huge impact. Last year, 7,000 of our patients who had previously been enrolled in UCARE had to change their health plans, and that resulted in cuts to our reimbursement ranging between 8 and 19%. So even though you didn't legislate that, that's a huge cut that many of us are experiencing. This year, 6,000 of our patients who are currently enrolled in Medica are going to be switched to other plans at the end of April when Medica drops out of participation in the program. So these are changes that weren't legislated, but they're causing deep cuts, and they're making it really difficult for us to retain our staff. We lost 4 dentists up in our Holly program last year who went to North Dakota, where the reimbursement rates are double. We're working in the safety net in North Dakota, not here in Minnesota. We've lost other dentists and providers as well. Our waiting lists have grown dramatically. Up in Holly, we have 1,200 patients on a waiting list now, double what we had last year. Similar in Rochester, similar in other parts of greater Minnesota. We've been forced to suspend or reduce some of our on-site services to nursing facilities and other places that really have no other place to go for dental care. So the situation is bad, and it's getting worse. So I wanted to speak briefly about the A1 amendment, which provides some immediate relief for safety net providers like AppleTree. This amendment would provide dental services grants that would help bridge funding gaps now, while the other elements of House File 1340 are being implemented. So in summary, I support House File 1340. It will help both private dentists and the safety net providers serve the patients that are depending on them at this time. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. And
all right. Thank you, Dr. Helgeson, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for Dr. Denzel or Dr. Helgeson? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Helgeson, thanks. Thanks for your testimony, and, you know, this is so important. We've been working on this for quite a few years, and I appreciate that you're still in there fighting to get Minnesota patients better services and make sure that they are taken care of. The question I have, you kind of touched on it, but the amendment and the bill, I'm kind of interested in how those two fit together. I know you said that the amendment sort of fills the gap, but I wonder, you know, is it because the bill, if the bill was, if we actually were able to raise the rates and do it right away, would that kind of take care of the need for the grants, or is the grant, you really need both, is kind of my question. I'm just a little worried that the grant gives sort of an out so that you won't get funding for the increase across the board is sort of my concern, because obviously we're going to have limited funding, and I sure hope that we could do the uniform prior authorization and all that stuff, but just a little more about how this all works.
Representative Pearson.
Representative Liebling, Mr. Chair, the governor's budget didn't include funding for some of the critical access programs, and that's what this amendment will fill that gap until the funding would kick in 2019.
Okay. Dr. Helgeson?
If we have this increase. Uh-huh.
Yes, Representative Liebling and members of the committee, it's bridge funding, you know, that would provide more immediate relief now until the other elements would take effect.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. And then, thank you, that's helpful. And then another question on the critical access funding. Could you just refresh my memory about, there was a ruling from CMS on the critical access funding that, you know, kind of threw a monkey wrench into things, and could you just kind of refresh your memory about what happened and how that impacts this?
Dr. Helgeson.
Yes, Representative Liebling and members of the committee. CMS felt that the methodology that was being used to pay the critical access providers was not a fit with their guidelines, and so they directed the health plans to implement a new payment methodology this year. Most of them have already done that. All of them have committed to that. And for the plans, I know that are administered by Health Partners and Delta Dental, those are implementing sort of real-time payments now for critical access, where they're adding the add-on along with the payments rather than the long months of delays and the sort of multiple payment layers that were involved in the system before. So I think it's an improvement, is my opinion.
Representative Liebling.
Oh, good. Well, thank you, Dr. Helgeson. I just kind of heard a little bit about it, and I was under the impression that it was not an improvement. So I'm glad to hear that it actually was moving in the right direction. So thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions for these two testifiers? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1340? Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Tom Lehman on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, the county-based purchasing plans of Prime West, Itasca Medical Care, and South Country. Just want to mention one thing to get it on the record that I've talked with Representative Pearson about. County-based purchasing plans agree with the importance of dental, which is why we pay our providers the highest rates in the state, and we have the highest participation and access to dental services by our enrollees. But I just wanted to mention one item of concern in the very last paragraph in the bill, starting on page line 4.17, talks about how the commissioner shall require managed care plans and county-based purchasing plans to increase the rates that we pay. But it's missing the equally important provision that DHS shall provide increased payments to the plan. We can't pass through payments to providers that we don't receive in the first place. And that's typically in this kind of language. I've met enough Representative Pearson, and as the bill moves forward, we'll continue to talk about that. But we agree with the importance of increasing rates. South Country, for example, has provided a grant to AppleTree to help them expand access in Little Falls for dental services. Dental services are critical to the health of our enrollees, and the funding is important, but we want to make sure that we're able to provide that funding after we get it from the department.
Great.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lehman, for your testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Lehman? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1340? Seeing none, are there any questions, final questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Pearson.
The omission wasn't personal, so we'll work on that and get that corrected before it gets to HHS finance, and thank you for your time.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1340 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 1340 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Representative Pearson. Next up, we have House File 1703, Representative Barr. Welcome to the committee. Representative Barr, I will move that House File 1703 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. And you have an amendment, Representative Barr, right?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
All right. I will move the DE1 amendment. Representative Barr, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in keeping with the freshman tradition, I did bring sheets today for everyone. So Emma is kind enough to pass those around.
Thank you, Representative Barr.
Thank you. I am very excited to be presenting this bill to your committee today, Mr. Chair and representatives. This bill is expanding access to evidence-based public health nursing home visits, and I think most of us know that we have a very large achievement gap in our state, and there are a couple of things that I really like about this bill. First of all, it increases access to the Nurse Family Partnership Program, and it specifically targets first-time low-income moms and their babies. And what I really like about this program is it's evidence-based, which appeals to my business background, and there's a very large return on investment. For every dollar invested, the return is $5.70. What's really important about this program is it works with a first-time low-income mom beginning early on, so prenatal, through her pregnancy and through birth up to 3 years of age. And what's really important about this program is that it benefits, or as I would say in the business world, it has legs. It not only benefits the health and well-being of the mom and the health and well-being of the baby, but it also benefits the health and well-being of the family. It also has a positive impact on their economic situation. For those of you who follow women and some of the economic disparity, if that happens to be a single low-income mom, the likelihood that she'll wind up in poverty later in life is very large. So I feel like this program, while it's focused on first-time mom and a baby between the ages of 1 and 3 years, it really can have a lifelong impact for that mother. With that note, I think I will conclude my remarks in the interest of keeping things on time. I do have a testifier, Mr. Chair, but I would be happy to take questions or hold off at your
Okay, are there any questions to the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted, and we have the bill in front of us as amended. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Chair Schumacher and committee members, Jenna Duenhager with the Nurse Family Partnership National Service Office. Nurse Family Partnership is a voluntary, evidence-based community health program that serves low-income women pregnant with their first child. Each new mom is partnered with a registered nurse early in her pregnancy and receives ongoing nurse home visits until that child turns 2 years old. The nurse home visitor works with our families in order to achieve the proven outcomes of NFP, which include improvement in pregnancy outcomes, improvement in child health and development, and improvement in parents' economic self-sufficiency. As an evidence-based program, Nurse Family Partnership is data and outcome-driven. Our data tracking and ongoing evaluation are built into our program and directly inform continuous quality improvements. This data allows us to show the lifelong impact of NFP that it has on our moms, babies, and families, as well as the impact on long-term reliance on government programs. Independent analysis by the Brookings Institute, the RAND Corporation, and the Washington State Institute for Public Policy have all documented that NFP produces a positive return on investment for government and society. A recent model developed by Dr. Ted R. Miller of the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation estimates that cumulative cost savings to Medicaid in Minnesota will be approximately $180 per visit by the time that child turns 23 months, with additional cost savings to Medicaid until that child turns 18. And as Representative Barr noted, we do see a return on investment of $5.70 in Minnesota for every dollar invested in NFP. And further specifics on our outcomes and return on investment can be found on the back of your handout. Currently, Minnesota plans reimburse for these services at levels somewhere between the current FFS rate of $88 per visit, although we hear that sometimes that's less, up to $200 per visit. And these rates really only reimburse a fraction of the average cost of the visit, which is $381. So we realize that you will all be faced with difficult decisions this session regarding funding priorities, but I would ask that you strongly consider that both the positive outcomes to our families' lives and the cost savings to the state attributed to these evidence-based models really far exceed the cost of these visits. Increasing the MA rate will support the sustainability of these cost-effective programs that impact the lives of Minnesota families. Thank you for your consideration. I would ask for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Duenhager, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill, and good morning. So I'm a big believer in home visiting. I think that this is one of those things that, as you say, it has tremendous return on investment of, you know, of the many things that we do in health and human services. This one, maybe because the timeline is so short, you can measure outcomes really well, and you can see that it really makes a difference. My question is, though, I have been told that these programs are not operating everywhere in the state. And so there are some, I guess the question's really sort of around the term, around the use of the term evidence-based. So does that mean that other programs that are operating, well, maybe you could just explain, you know, where these programs are operating. So what is the reach of this bill?
Ms. Duenhager.
I can only speak to Nurse Family Partnership, and currently we are in 40 of the Minnesota counties.
Representative Woodley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Representative Barr, do you know what, if there's more reach to the bill than that?
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. Right now, the bill is specifically focused on evidence-based. I'm a big fan on programs that show a return on investment. And when I looked at this program, for the reasons that I stated earlier, I just feel like it's a win-win all the way around. I would be happy at a future time, certainly, to look at other programs and see if there's opportunities to expand that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I'd be interested if maybe if there's somebody else in the room that can tell us where this is, because I have been told that it's not all over the state.
All right. It looks like we have someone making their way forward. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Sure. My name is Don Reckinger, and I'm the section manager for family home visiting at the Department of Health. And this would also cover Healthy Families America, which is an evidence-based model. Technically, there are 14 evidence-based models that are approved. In Minnesota, we only implement about three of them. It would not cover Family Spirit if it was implemented by a community health worker, because this requires public health nursing. I think there are about, I have to look at the map, but about 30 to 35 counties that are implementing Healthy Families America, and many of them, they overlap with Nurse Family Partnership. So we would estimate maybe about half of the counties in Minnesota would be able to benefit from the way this is worded.
Representative Whitley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think that there might be more to understand here than just, I think it's quite possible that everybody on the committee really supports the concept of home visiting. But I think there's more to understand about these are different, there are particular programs that are considered evidence-based. I'm not really sure if that's a certification or as we usually understand that term, it's not a yes or no thing whether something's evidence-based. It's sort of a matter of degree, I would say, right? How much evidence has come in to support particular practices. And I've been learning recently that in this context, evidence-based means certain programs have a certain kind, are certified, I guess, as evidence-based, and then other programs maybe have similar practices or the same practices but don't have that certification, so we don't use the term evidence-based. Could you maybe explain that a little bit from the, you know, beyond this bill, sort of give us the context for that?
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative. That's a really good question. I think we would probably use the terms evidence-informed and evidence-based. So we would think of an evidence-based as sort of a whole package where someone has done a lot of research on the full model, they've put together a lot of practices, they've looked at dosage, they've looked at frequency, they've looked at what type of multiple interventions, they've looked at the length of time. So the two models that I mentioned before, both Healthy Families America and Nurse Family Partnership, have lots of research behind them, you know, randomized control trials, where, again, they've looked at sort of what we would call a whole package. And they said, if you do this over 3 years and you follow this frequency and this dosage intensity, we can show that you should get these outcomes. I think evidence-informed, there certainly are evidence-informed practices. Like, we know there's a lot of evidence-informed practices about breastfeeding. What we find with those people who are doing maybe more the traditional family home visiting with excellent nurses with good intention is they don't have the funding to do the full package. So they might see someone for 3 visits, they might see someone for 4 months. I think people would recognize that if you see someone for 4 months versus 3 years, you're probably going to get different outcomes. So they would not, when you're doing sort of evidence-informed, you wouldn't qualify for the accreditation status that these models require. I don't know if that helps answer the question.
Representative Liebling.
Well, it does. Thank you. I appreciate that. And so I guess, I certainly think that we should be investing in home visiting, no question. And, you know, the more high quality it is, the better. But I am just a little, and I certainly support the bill, but I just am a bit concerned that it only focuses on half the counties, and I'm kind of wondering, I want this to be for all Minnesotans and not just half. So, or half the counties. That may not be half the Minnesotans. I don't know right now which counties we're talking about. But anyway, thank you.
Sure.
Are there any other questions for testifiers, Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I think maybe the testifier that's stepping away, and this might be a question for you. So could you just speak to the geography of where the gaps are, and then maybe the bill author too, in the plan to get more folks to be able to become certified, or if there is plans to be able to expand this into the areas where there are gaps?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'll need to defer to the testifier.
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. So you're wondering, like, what some larger plans are to, one, where the gaps were, and then two, what would be to try and address those gaps.
Correct.
So I would say that a large part of the gaps are in our rural parts of Greater Minnesota, the Twin Cities, 7-county, 11-county metro, has a significant amount of funding that we receive from our federal partners. It's called the, we shorten it to MICV, but it's the Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting Program. It covers about 20 to 30% of the need in our state. That it's spread across the state, but a large part of it is funded in the metro area. We have a few, probably half of it's in the metro, half of it's in Greater Minnesota. A huge need where there are not evidence-based programs right now is in southern Minnesota. I can name the 3 counties that have them. Faribault Martin, Olmsted has it, and Mauer has it. And really, if you look at the rest of the southern, so that's 4, southern Minnesota, they don't have the populations that sometimes to run an evidence-based program, you need sort of a certain
population, like with Nurse Family Partnership, you need 100 families to be able to sort of get it up and running. And so you can imagine some of our small counties don't have 100 families that would qualify, so they'd have to join regionally to make that happen. Healthy Families America is not as restrictive that way, so that's, it has a little more flexibility. But it does take, to run an evidence-based program, it does take some sort of basic infrastructure. There's a number of things that are required, you know, components that you wouldn't normally get reimbursed. You'd have to have sort of a basic infrastructure to do that. I don't know if that's addressing your question.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think that's getting at the heart of it. I mean, you know, making sure that we're not accidentally making disparities greater between the counties that can do this and the counties that don't. I'd love to see how we can move more of the counties that don't have these evidence-based certifications into bill to benefit from this bill. So I don't know how we do that, but I just want to say that so that we're making sure that we're not accidentally making disparities greater. But I do support the bill, but want to make sure that we're not having unintended consequences long term.
Any other questions for the testifiers? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1703? Any final questions for the bill author? Last word, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher and representatives, and I do appreciate the feedback that I received here, and I will continue to take a look at that. With that, I will say I think this is a great bill and an opportunity to really help address two issues that I see: the achievement gap by investing in our young low-income moms, because it will also pay off throughout not only their children's life cycle but also theirs as well. Thank you.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1703, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1703, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Representative Barr. Next up, I will move that House File 1176, with Representative Hamilton, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Hamilton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This bill has been developed by a broad group of providers. We seek to align the payment systems with the services delivered as it pertains to the mental health services. And with that, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers to walk us through the bill and offer testimony.
Okay, and Representative Hamilton, you have the A1 amendments here as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right, I will move the A1 amendments. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, to your bill as amended.
All right. And once again, Mr. Chairman, if I could turn it over to the testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the executive director of Aspire Minnesota. Section 1 of the bill basically just simplifies and equalizes rates for services provided by mental health professionals, all of whom are working at the top of their licensing role based on their individual boards. Section 2 has two provisions. The first, in paragraph E, is a response to new federal managed care rules that allow states to set a floor for managed care medical assistance for certain services. And the floor that would be set here for managed care for mental health services is that it would be equal to the fee-for-service rate, at least equal to the fee-for-service rate. In addition, there are two quality measures that the state would track in response, and one of those is access to mental health services, and the other is inpatient hospitalizations. Then paragraph F, sets rate increases for all mental health services at 10% effective in January of 2018 and 20% for psychiatry services.
All right, are there any questions for Ms. Regan? Seeing none, Representative Hamilton, do you have any other testifiers?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Combe. And I actually have some handouts that Good morning, Chair Schumacher and committee members. My name is Stephanie Combe. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker and the senior director of mental health services at St. David's Center. I'm also speaking on behalf of members of Aspire Minnesota in support of House File 1176. I'm grateful to the members of this committee for this opportunity. For the past 20 years, I have been a leader of mental health services for children in the nonprofit sector. In that time, I've seen many changes in the array of services available and an increase in the awareness of mental health issues in children and adults in our state. Research and professional training on areas such as brain development, the impact of adverse childhood experiences, trauma, and autism have allowed us to implement more effective treatments. Innovative interventions have helped us reach those who face barriers to accessing services. Early childhood mental health services have helped children be ready for kindergarten from a socio-emotional perspective. School-linked mental health services have helped children manage their mental health symptoms in a way that allows them to succeed in school and help their teachers understand the students' challenges in the classroom and ways to intervene. Families who have experienced significant trauma have gained insight and healing. Significant progress has been made in reducing the stigma of mental illness and increasing awareness in the importance of early intervention. For many reasons, I'm grateful to be a mental health professional in the state of Minnesota. However, while we have been innovative in many ways, unfortunately our mental health rates have not kept up with the increasing cost to provide the services. To illustrate this challenge, I've prepared a chart for you, and what you will see is a sample of some of the common outpatient mental health rates dating back to 2010. As you can see, the rates have been stagnant or decreased in that time. During that same time, our costs have increased. Along with the typical increase in employee salary and benefit costs, in order to maintain compliance with entities such as HIPAA and labor laws, agencies such as ours have had to invest in electronic health records, human resources information systems, and increased supervision and training costs. For agencies serving a high number of medical assistance recipients, the stagnant rates in light of increased costs have become unsustainable. Complicating the challenge of the stagnant medical assistance fee-for-service rates, we have been impacted by the decision by several PMAPs to no longer pay the fee-for-service rate as a base rate. It is not uncommon for PMAPs to pay at rates that are 4% or more lower than the fee-for-service rate. With fee-for-service rates already being inadequate, allowing PMAPs to pay a lower rate only leads to an even more fragile system of care. As I noted earlier, I'm grateful to be a mental health professional in Minnesota. I've been privileged to work with dedicated professionals who are committed to meeting the mental health needs of our most at-risk citizens. I'm here to ask you to ensure that they have the financial resources to continue their incredible work. I ask for your support to increase the fee-for-service mental health rates by 10% and require PMAPs to pay at a minimum the fee-for-service rate. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Comby, for your testimony this morning. Mr. Edwards.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for taking the time to hear my testimony. My name is Rob Edwards. I'm the executive director at Lee Carlson Center for Mental Health and Well-Being. We provide service to about 4,000 individuals every year. Our main service area is Anoka County, Greater Anoka County. Of those 4,000, 70% are Medicaid insured or Medicaid managed care insured, so a significant number of our client base. Provision in this bill, paragraph E, would incorporate an important safeguard for mental health providers that serve clients insured by health insurance plans that contract with the state to provide coverage to Medicaid recipients. That safeguard requires state contract managed care insurers to pay providers at least the MA reimbursement rate and no less. Currently, when the state contracts with a new insurance plan that may not have a history covering members in a certain geography in our state, providers can overnight end up with a new insurance plan covering MA-eligible consumers that they've never worked with before or had the opportunity to negotiate a contract with. In 2015, we had a great partnership at our agency with UCARE, providing insurance coverage to 50% of our entire client base. That's about 2,000 members. On January 1st, 2016, without any notice, Medica then became the default managed care insurers of all our former UCARE insured. As UCARE exited that role, Medica was the low contract bidder with the state and awarded the role of default insurer for the members who did not choose Blue Cross or Health Partners. Medica had no prior role in covering our customers in our geographic service area. Therefore, we did not have a contract with Medica. But they were effectively an unknown insurer in our geography. Overnight, our reimbursement rates dropped to 50% of the MA rate for those 50% consumers. We were immediately aware of this. We got in touch with all sorts of people, both at the state, but of course all across the health plan. Many layers of the medic organization who works very closely with the larger Optum organization. I spent 9 months advocating on behalf of just establishing a contract with rates that would be at the MA rate level of reimbursement or higher. 9 months, we received reimbursement for half of our client base at half of what it had been the year before, leading to major cash flow issues. This was a contracting maneuver that was done at the state level without much notice to providers. Again, this provider was outside of our systems prior to this occurring, and really led to a very big challenge with our cash flow and our reimbursement. I think the paragraph E provides a really important safeguard when private companies contract with the state to take care of managed care members, that they would pay at least the same that medical assistants would pay for reimbursement. We spent a long time. I finally was able to connect with someone 10 months to the day after I started the negotiation process, finding that person in San Francisco with the Optum organization. Was able to get my rates set and a retroactive payment made, but very challenging for the organization. The other provision I just want to speak to very briefly is paragraph F around psychiatry reimbursement. As a nonprofit organization, we staff two child and adolescent psychiatrists. One adult psychiatrist serves the adult population. We are able to get folks in for psychiatry within about 2 to 3 months. A lot of other places, folks have to wait 6 to 7 months. We do this because we're a nonprofit organization and we have a mission to making sure that our clients can get access to all the services they need. This is available to our entire client base of 4,000 plus individuals every year. But we subsidize psychiatry services. It costs us about 30% more than we're reimbursed through health plans for psychiatry. And with the majority of that population being the medical assistance clientele, 70%, and the psychiatry rates being even lower, it's very challenging for us to continue to balance that program on the backs of our other nonprofit programming. But we do it. We continue to do it. The provision in paragraph F really brings us up a notch in terms of psychiatry reimbursement. Doesn't bring us all the way to where we need to be to make that program balance, and we will continue to provide that programming at a loss, but the 20% increase in paragraph F emphasized is a necessary increase to allow us to do that programming. So thank you very much for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be willing to answer.
All right. Ms. Johnson. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, committee chair members. My name is Kristen Johnson. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to House File 1176. We all know that increased reimbursement for mental health services is needed for medical assistance. I want to speak to the part of this bill that would equalize pay between the master and doctoral level providers. Our master's level colleagues are invaluable to the mental health profession, but we are not providing the same level of services and should not be reimbursed at the same rate. Briefly, I would like to share with you about my background. I'm a fourth-year student in the doctoral psychology program at St. Mary's University of Minnesota. I received a master's degree in forensic psychology in 2010 and have worked as a therapist in forensic settings, including the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake. I then made the decision to pursue my doctorate in counseling psychology. It has been an eye-opening experience. After completing my master's, I thought I was a competent therapist and that I knew what it took to be a psychologist. But once I started my doctoral program, I realized how much more there was to learn. There's a significant difference in the knowledge base and skills level between the master's and doctoral providers. Right now in Minnesota, there are 1,900 doctoral psychologists. We're the oldest health profession in Minnesota, and many of our doctoral psychologists will be retiring within the next 5 years. This bill, by equalizing pay for master's and doctoral providers, would essentially raise rates 30% for master's providers, 20% for psychiatric services, and only 10% for doctoral-level psychologists. Most students pursuing doctoral degrees in clinical practice graduate with debt of $100,000 or more. If students do not see a financial benefit to advancing their education from the master's level to the doctoral level psychologist, we could eventually see a workforce crisis for doctoral psychologists similar to the one currently impacting psychiatrists. If Minnesota wants to maintain a strong workforce that includes sufficient numbers of doctoral psychologists, there must be incentive to pursue this training. Please keep the differential for master's versus doctoral providers to incentivize students to complete the additional 4 to 5 years of training needed for a robust workforce. Thank you, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1176? Please make your way to the committee table. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name once again for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Langman, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. Just one comment. We recognize the desire of the bill to eliminate the disparity between master's level and PhD level, but it maintains the disparity on lines 1.14 and 1.15 for those physician assistants that are prescribing psychiatric medications, and it maintains the disparity there. And we would just ask, as the bill moves forward, that the author consider limiting that disparity as well.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1176? Seeing none, questions for the bill author? Okay. Representative Liebling.
So, thank you to that last young lady who testified about the disparity. That was something that maybe I wouldn't have thought about much if you hadn't come to the table. So appreciate that you're here, and I do think that's a concern. I hope Representative Hamilton will think about that one as we go forward here. I can see him nodding. What I really wanted to talk about, though, is the reimbursement issue. That's the second part of the bill. And it's another place that we're getting a piece of the theme that is running through a lot of what we're doing this year about PMAP and what it means to have managed care organizations that we hire and put in between the public dollars that go for Medicaid and the providers. And I have two different bills submitted this session to change this system, to go to direct contracting. So, Representative Hamilton, where you're saying in this bill, let's not let them pay less than the state's fee. Hallelujah, let's not. You know, this is right, but we've got to do more than this. See, we're tinkering around the edges of a bad system that we could fix in large part by simply taking out the middleman. And this, what we have here, the very fact that the MCOs are, some of them at least, paying less than the state would pay directly under fee-for-service is amazing. It should be amazing to all the members. I mean, we're hearing this. Yesterday I was speaking to a dentist who was telling me the same thing in dental care. You know, we're hiring these organizations, and they're paying our providers less than they would get paid if they were paid directly from the state. This is a system that has run its course and needs to be examined from top to bottom, and I believe we should be getting out of we should not be hiring them. Home-based purchasing has worked very well, but it's different. It's transparent. It's run by public officials. People know what providers are getting paid. We, the legislators, don't even know what our providers are getting paid under Medicaid. So, you know, this committee's had a very busy schedule, but we're not dealing with the big issue. I have two bills in on this thing, and the difference between the two bills is the way the direct contracting would be done. the chair hasn't even chosen to hear these bills. But that would address the real problem, get to the root of the problem, because it isn't just with mental health. It's across the spectrum. And every provider I talk to who's seeing Medicaid patients is struggling with the same issue. Why in the world do they have to, you know, if it's a Medicaid patient and there's a set of Medicaid benefits and so on, why in the world are we making providers deal with different insurance companies all for Medicaid patients and have these changes that we were just hearing about? It just makes absolutely no sense. So, Representative Hamilton, this part of the bill I fully support, but I think it's just a little drop in the bucket, and we really, really ought to deal with the bigger issue. And this should not be a partisan issue. In the past, it hasn't been. And I think members on both sides, as we hear these stories, we just have to realize the system we have has failed. And instead of tinkering around the edges, we at least ought to examine how we might revamp it. And this is not, you know, this is not about, you know, it shouldn't be a partisan issue, because these are public patients, public dollars. And not only that, this is taking on extra urgency because we know that Congress is going to cut our Medicaid dollars, cut our funding. And so all these great bills that members are bringing forward that want to do additional things with our Medicaid dollars, raise rates. How the heck are we going to raise rates when we still have this dysfunctional system? And I don't know how we're even going to know if they've raised the rates, Representative Hamilton, because under our current system, we, the members, don't get to know, because they're going to tell us it's proprietary. I don't know how we can even do this, because we could tell them to do it, but we'd never know if they were doing it. And the providers aren't even allowed to tell us, I understand, because they are going to maybe be threatened with being sued for giving away proprietary information. I mean, this is nuts, and it needs to be changed. And so we really should be hearing the bills that and deal with the bigger issue. So I just hope members can, you know, kind of come together around this, because it's obviously a problem that's affecting the entire state, and we just can't afford to do this into the future. We have to get control of our Medicaid program and know where our dollars are going and who's making what and what exactly we're paying. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling, thank you so much. And I'm going to read your bills, and I may just become a co-author.
Thank you.
You know, this is a bigger issue than this. I have a prior authorization bill that I haven't been able to get a hearing on, and I'm working on that. And I'm very fired up about this whole issue. And it is bigger than what we're trying to do here. So I want to visit with you after this. I want to read through your bills, and I just may become a co-author on.
Thank you
for your comment.
Any other questions on House File 1176? Final word, Representative Hamilton.
I ask for your support.
With that, I'll renew my motion on House File 1176 as amended to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. House File 1176 as amended to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Next, we will take up House File 1561, Representative Hamilton. I'll move that House File 1561 be referred to Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have an A1 amendment. Representative Hamilton, to the amendment.
I remove the A1 amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment reinstates the stricken language on page 2, line 1, and inserts the number 10. Instead of 3, it inserts the number of 10.
Are there any questions on the A1 amendment?
What did you just say?
Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this bill expands access to telemedicine services, and I do have some testifiers that will walk us through the bill and offer testimony.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and state your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeannie Palin. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We are the member association for 36 community-based mental health programs across Minnesota, serving more than 100,000 Minnesota families, children, and individuals seeking and needing mental health and behavioral health services. We are essential community providers in that we serve everyone who comes to our door, regardless of their insurance status, their ability to pay, or where they live. Thank you, Representative Hamilton, for bringing this forward. Thank you to our co-authors, and thank you to the committee for hearing our bill this morning. House File 1561, as amended, does seek to increase the number of telemedicine encounters for medical assistance, and adds mental health practitioners as eligible providers for telemedicine services. Mental health practitioners play critical roles in delivering mental health services, especially now as we're in a workforce shortage for mental health professionals. And we believe expanding access to telemedicine through House File 1561 will increase access to mental health services, particularly in greater Minnesota. We ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Reitmeier?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shauna Reitmeier, and I'm the CEO for the Northwestern Mental Health Center. We are the only community mental health center in a six-county region of Northwest Minnesota. And some of you may have heard me say this before when I've been here, but we are the geographic size of about the state of Vermont. And the difference is, though, is that Vermont has about 70 people per square mile, and we have approximately 7. So I am very appreciative and thank the legislature for passing the Telemedicine Act in 2015, because that really helped increase access to mental health services in an affordable way. However, it's my hope of where that legislation ended, this will pick up and help expand even further. Because when that legislation was passed, what it did is it only allowed licensed providers to be able to deliver telemedicine services, and it put a cap of only 3 encounters per week to be provided. For community mental health centers, we provide critical, supportive, and stabilizing services to individuals, but we provide them with many non-licensed providers. They're experienced, they're trained, and they provide those supportive services in programs such as ARMS, CTSS, and mobile crisis teams. These programs are certified by the Department of Human Services, and they go through a rigorous review process to ensure quality, to ensure that the training requirements are met by those practitioners, and the practitioners are supervised by mental health professionals. So I can share just a little bit about what happened in my agency when that legislation passed. It actually made us have to scale back the full implementation of an initiative that we were working on with one of our outlying hospitals. We were working on a telemedicine initiative where we would respond to individuals in crisis that entered their emergency department, and we would connect with them by telemedicine. But when that happened, what ended up happening is that because the majority of our mobile crisis teams and across the state are delivered by mental health practitioners, those non-licensed individuals. And so now, instead of that practitioner, when we get the call, being able to connect with that hospital in a matter of minutes, they now have to get in the car and drive an hour one way in many instances. So what that ended up doing is it ended up having that staff stuck in the car, not being able to see other people that might be in need, but most often that person that's in crisis at that moment didn't get to see anybody for an hour. So the other thing is in a crisis situation, it is one of the most critical times to engage with an individual to help motivate them into ongoing treatment. And for people that have been in a crisis, it is not unheard of that you may follow that person for many days after a crisis to help continue stabilization. And in some instances, you may need to see that individual may need to see multiple providers in one day. They may need an assessment by a professional to determine ongoing crisis services. They may need a stabilization services on that same day to help keep them utilizing their coping skills. And they may also need to see their psychiatrist for medication adjustments. And so right there in one day, those 3 encounters are utilized. And that's not even to say that they may have primary care or specialty care that is seen in through telemedicine, especially in the rural and frontier area. And so being able to provide services through telemedicine by mental health practitioners and increasing the frequency will support that individual's recovery.
It can reduce the impact of high-cost care, such as inpatient hospitalization or incarcerations, and it will also help shift our scarce resources to being able to provide service and treating people instead of spending time on the road. The other piece with this telemedicine bill that will help support is Minnesota's demonstration project for the certified community behavioral health clinics, because one of the really reinforced areas is that they're encouraging states that have been awarded these demonstrations, which Minnesota was one of them, to maximize the use of telemedicine services. And so I want to thank Representative Hamilton for bringing this bill forward, and I encourage your support, and I'm open to any questions. Thank you.
Are there any questions for these testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1561? Seeing none, final questions for the bill author?
This is a great bill. I ask for your support.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1561 as amended to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1561 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Next on the agenda is House File 1349. Representative Franzen is out ill today, but Representative Zerwas will be carrying this as a co-author. So I will move that House File 1349 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Zerwas, when you're ready, we have the bill in front of us.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 1349, and members, thank you for letting me to pinch in for Representative Franzen, who's ill today, and understand that I'm stepping in at the last moment, so I apologize for my perhaps limited insight into some of the details. House File 1349 restores critical access funding to ensure more low-income individuals are getting access to dental treatment. Both the author and the individuals with caring hands have been working closely with the department, although the department doesn't yet feel like they can support this language. Those negotiations are ongoing, and I'm hopeful that as this bill moves towards finance, the department and those parties interested can reach an agreement to allow Caring Hands Dentistry to continue to impact as many people in greater Minnesota as possible. Mr. Chair and members, with that, I'll turn it over to the testifier who can explain some of the challenges they're facing in greater Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Olson. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Well, I'm Al Olson from the Caring Hands Dental Clinic. Excuse me. My wife and I started the clinic back in 2006 with a group of individuals. Excuse me. Not enough coffee this morning. And it was a volunteer organization that seen a tremendous need in rural Minnesota for dental care. As the volunteers produced more and more services on Fridays, their days off, we were inundated with treatment needs. Those treatment needs expanded so highly that I finally talked to some of our volunteer dentists and asked them if they had spare empty chair time. And they said yes, they did, but they did not want to be an MA provider. But they would be willing to work with us to provide some care as their time and chairs allowed. So I went to the DHS and we started discussions on the More Smiles program, which stated that these providers could see my patients at their office bills me, I pay them what I get. It was a money-losing proposition because of the administrative costs that we incurred. So we had the program, but they would not give us the critical access payment for it. So we took it and ran, and we soon were seeing hundreds of patients in rural Minnesota. Our territory covers, through our outreach, about 34 counties in central, western, and southwestern Minnesota. We have mobile outreach for hygiene and many other services, including nursing homes. Unable to keep up to it, the More Smiles program kept
asking for the critical access payment on those to cover our administrative costs. In 2013, the legislature gave us the critical access payment. 2014, the Department of Human Service, via the CMS, I understand, took it away. By that time, I had increased the volume of Morse Miles to about $140,000 I was paying out. I was now going to lose a lot of money. I was going to disband the program because of the cost of administrating it. Prime West Health stepped in, who is our major insurer in our area, and they pay us a grant now to keep the program going for their patients. Last year I paid out $215,000 to providers to see our patients in rural Minnesota. This is all the way to Pipestone, Litchfield, all the way down the border, Morris. Of that $215,000, $198,000 of that was Prime West patients, of which we got our grant money to subsidize our administrative costs. So we are looking for expanding the program more. We have a lot of dentists in the area. Brought up earlier about the removing the 10% cap. These dentists, most of them in the rural area, could not afford to do 10%, but they can take whatever they can take from me. We produced just under 1,000 appointments last year through the More Smiles program, and those people otherwise would not get care or have to travel for many hours to get to our facility in Alexandria. So we're hoping to establish the critical access payment program again on that so that we can survive and provide those cares where there is no place to go for them in those areas. I am working, as Representative Zerwas mentioned, that we are in negotiations per se, or discussions we have been for some months with the Department of Human Service, of finding a way to make this work to satisfy the federal government and the state. I'm hoping that we can get that resolved and not too far down the road. If not, I ask for your support to try to establish the critical access payment for our program.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifier, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's Dr. Olson, right?
No, not doctor.
Not doctor. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your great work. And we had a visit yesterday, and I got to hear a lot more about this, and I really appreciated that because, really, you do tremendous service to the people of Minnesota, and that's great. I mean, honestly, I think I don't know if other states have so many people who do these kinds of things, but it's really tremendous. The question about the language of the bill is it talks about urgent care dental services, and then it says as an alternative to the hospital emergency room for non-emergency dental care. I'm just a little confused by those terms, so I take it that emergency dental care has to be delivered. That's not what you're talking about. You're talking about urgent as opposed to emergency. And I'm not that familiar with, I guess, with the nuts and bolts of dentistry to understand the difference. Could you just clarify that for me?
Mr. Olson.
Chairman, Representative, part of the reason we started the More Smiles program was for dental emergencies. Part of the reason our clinic began in 2006 was to keep dental emergencies out of our local Douglas County Hospital emergency room. National studies I've read say a dental emergency going to a hospital emergency room costs between $550 and $900 per visit. That's just the pharmaceutical care revolving door. So that was the initial means for Caring Hands Dental Clinic to start. It then expanded into full dentistry. And so we do have, we're in a situation, say in southwestern Minnesota, a public health nurse calls, say we got a 10-year-old girl has a toothache, can you help us? I say, yes, I have a provider in Pipestone, let me call them. The provider in Pipestone will take care of that emergency for us. They also do treatment for us. If we go to, for example, Pipestone, we go there once a month at least and provide our mobile hygiene treatment down there, which we find treatment needs to be done then and after the exam. And we can now provide that treatment to a lot of those patients down there. The one doctor in Pipestone provided over 500 appointments for us last year. He is willing to work with me, but he will only work with me. He doesn't want to be an MA provider. He wants to work through our More Smiles program. So we do see dental emergencies. We do see treatment. And there's times where some of our More Smiles patients have established a dental home, so they get their cleanings, their exams, their treatment, emergencies, all handled at their new dental home, which is through the More Smiles program.
Representative Whitley.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm still a little confused just about the terms that are in the bill. So, you know, because it's saying that the dental clinic or provider would, in collaboration with the hospital emergency room, shall provide urgent care dental services as an alternative to the hospital emergency room for non-emergency dental care. So I assume that this isn't meant to as an alternative to emergency dental care. I'm just wondering what would be I'm assuming people show up the emergency room for a dental reason, and some of that would be considered emergency dental care, and some of it would be considered for non-emergency dental care. It's all urgent, obviously, but I'm just wondering if there's a technical, why does it say for non-emergency dental care? Isn't it just anybody who shows up at an emergency room for a dental reason that you're going to try to divert to a real dentist? Or I shouldn't say it that way, but, you know, to divert from the emergency room to another more appropriate facility.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representative. So the emergency situation versus non-emergency would be the non-traumatic. So if it's a traumatic situation and the hospital sees that it is, they're going to direct them. A lot of times in our county, they direct them right to us. In other counties, they go through the public health or social service and try to find help for those traumatic situations. The non-emergency situations are probably more where there is just swelling but not much pain, and potentially the hospital would give them some antibiotics, which is what we would give them if they came to our clinic with a non-emergency or non-traumatic situation.
Representative Whitley.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So that, I think that does help. So, in other words, in a situation where it's reasonable to have a delay, that's kind of how I'm understanding what you're saying, right? In some situations, it may be just so severe that it just makes no sense to divert them anywhere, and they just have to get some treatment right then and there. But other than that, is the stuff you're calling non-emergency, where it's possible to take the time to refer them elsewhere.
Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. Yes, that is correct. So there is a wide range of services provided through More Smiles.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Law 1349? Seeing none, final questions for Representative Zerwas. Final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for letting me present this on Representative Franson's behalf.
With that, I'll renew my motion to House Bill 1349 to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House Bill 1349 is be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Next up, we'll take House File 1350. Same story here. Franson out, Zerwas in. I will move House File 1350. Be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Zerwas, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Chair, you are getting good. I like it. I tell you what, similar circumstance, I'm pinching again. Although House File 1350 this is language that I have worked on in the past. This deals with MA spend down and the difficult position that providers get in when they are kind of caught in the middle as being the collectors of MA spend down. And so when providers are put in that position of being a collections office instead of DHS, what ends up happening are patients that go to a rural dental provider where there really aren't that many providers, and then there's an MA spend down to be collected. The challenge is if the patient doesn't pay that spend down, naturally the providers are in a difficult position where they can't really continue to see that patient. That significantly limits where that patient would go. This bill changes the spend down procedure to keep people coming back to their dentist in rural Minnesota, keeping them out of the emergency rooms, and having the department step in that kind of collections role. Because we're trying to preserve the dentist-doctor-patient relationship, where a dentist office is still somewhere that a low-income individual on Medicaid can come back to and not feel like they have a outstanding bill, and so they have no place in greater Minnesota to go for treatment. That's the thought process behind the bill. Mr. Chair, Mr. Olson is available for questions. I think some comments on this as well.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Olson. If you could please once again state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Olson, Caring Hands Dental Clinic. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. The spend down bill was brought up last year in our legislature and didn't go through, and we like the bill from our standpoint because, as Representative Zerloff says, it does create problems for us, and more so for us, it creates them for the patient. The patient comes to our clinic, they're on a spend down program. We do the dental procedures that are needed, and we bill the state. The state sends us back our explanation of benefits with either a payment or no payment. If we get no payment, we have the right to go back to the patient and get up to and including retail. We actually offer our patients a discounted amount. We offer them monthly payments. And in most cases, the patients do not pay us. So the thousands of dollars a year we lose is one factor, but not the biggest one. The biggest factor is it's now created an uninsured person who owes us money, who we're willing to work with, but they don't come back for treatment. Now that treatment goes south. They end up in the emergency room, they bounce around from provider to provider, and they end up owing everybody money. And again, as mentioned, we are not good at collecting. We don't have the resources or the funding for it. We bill the people three times nicely, and then we just eat it. We can't keep doing that. And again, it's unfair to the patient because they're embarrassed they owe us money. I feel sorry for them. Again, we'll work with them any way we can. We have one patient that now for a couple of years that gives us $5 every month. And we're happy to get it just to keep them going with the treatment. Because as we know, if the treatment's not taken care of, then they're going to end up in problems.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Olson? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 1350? Seeing none, questions for the author? Representative
Wigley. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Olson. Not so much for the author, but I just wondered if someone from DHS might want to come down and talk about this a little bit. Maybe Ms. Marquardt or somebody else in the room. Because, you know, this spend-down system is, it's crazy, too. And I we've been struggling with this for a long time in a lot of different contexts, not just dental. And it is really a system that's hard to understand why we do it the way we do it. And I just wondered if we could get some explanation of, you know, does DHS have a position on this bill and maybe give us a little context about how this program works.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kim Carlin from the Department of Human Services. The spend down program is a program where if somebody does not meet the income standards for medical assistance, then they can achieve eligibility by spending down to the income standard by subtracting their incurred medical expenses from their income. How that works then is, for example, if the person is $100 over the income standard, they have to show that they have incurred $100 or more in medical bills. They are responsible to pay for that $100 in medical bills, and then medical assistance pays covered services in amounts over that. The department doesn't have a position on the bill. The mechanics of this would require the department to take over the collection piece from providers for that amount that would be owed for the spend down.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could you just sort of describe how that works now? So a person is a little bit over the income standard, and by the way, I know from other bills that we've heard and so on that they actually have to spend down to below the income standard. And this is, I think maybe Representative Zerwas has worked on this to try to raise it so they only have to spend down to where other people start at. But putting that aside, because that complicates it even further, so how does this exactly work? If a person, say, is $100 over the income standard, and just assuming for simplicity that they only spend down to the same level as everybody else, you know, from their point of view, or, you know, just what happens? Do they go sign up with MA, and then what are they, who gets that $100, or who collects the $100?
Ms. Bowen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you're correct. For the group in this bill, which is targeted to people who are age 65 or older, blind, or who have a disability, that in their regular income standard is 100%. The spend down standard is 80%. So if they have any amount of income over 100% of the income standard, they have to spend down to the 80%. If their spend down amount is $100 and they show they have incurred medical bills, they will show eligible for medical assistance with a spend down. The providers, I believe, can see that in the system. But what happens is then the providers submit claims. The claims system rejects the first $100 of bills that are submitted and starts paying with bill 101, if you will. And so let's say the person is going to multiple providers. That spend down is applied to the first provider who submits a claim. And then once that $100 of incurred bills has been submitted, everything is paid for the remainder of a six-month period. At the end of each 6 months, the spend down is recalculated, and that process starts over. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's helpful. So the provider, when the provider submits the bill, as Mr. Olson was talking about, he has no idea whether that spend down is satisfied or not. And if the bill comes back and says, well, this person owes $100, then he has to go out and get that person to pay the $100 or just eat the $100, right?
Ms. Garland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that is correct. Once the remittance advice is returned to the provider, it will tell the provider how much medical assistance will pay and how much, if any, is the obligation of the patient.
Representative Whitman. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so DHS has no position on the bill, and I guess we'll see when we get to finance what DHS's position on the bill really is.
Any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on 1350? I think we might have already done that. Representative Zerwas, final word.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for helping me pitch in for Representative Franson. And just one comment on kind of the spend down and billing. One of the ways, Representative Liebling, I've had it described to me by some providers, is the race to bill last. Because you want to bill after they've met that spend down amount, so then you don't have to try to collect it from them. You just get your check from DHS. I worked on this issue last year. The fiscal note is significant on this. My guess is DHS doesn't want to do this. And so I think the challenge is, in this instance specifically, what we have in greater Minnesota is we're putting providers and we're putting patients with a very limited resource of dentists. We're putting them in a very difficult position. And if they go for that initial treatment but then avoid coming back, we're making things worse through a public policy that's supposedly designed to help people.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry that I know that was supposed to be your last word, Representative Zerwas, but I just want to make it really clear. I'm not saying that DHS is going to put a big fiscal note because they don't like it, because, in fact, just, we know that this, fixing this messy, awful thing also will cost a lot of money. So I just want to be really clear, and, you know, and we're not accusing DHS of trying to kill it by fiscal note. It's just that it really will cost a lot of money to straighten it out. As much as we'd all like to do that, we have to see if that's something we can really do. Thanks.
I've never heard of DHS killing something by fiscal note, so I wouldn't suggest that.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House Bill 1350 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House Bill 1350 is be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. And members are going to go out of order for the last bit here because I have testifiers who cannot return tonight, and so next up will be House Bill 1115.
While Chair Schumacher is going forward, I'll move House File 115 to be referred to HHS Finance.
That should be House File 1115.
Or 1115, what did I say?
1115.
Yep, 1115. Chair Schumacher, welcome to the committee and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is an attempt to alleviate the backlog of psych patients that hospitals are experiencing because of the lack of beds in longer-term treatment facilities such as Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and the seven community behavior health hospitals in Minnesota. We need more placement options for patients with mental health complications and concurrent medical problems that prohibit their placement into regular community facilities. This especially includes patients who need nursing home level of medical care but present a challenge to these facilities due to the lack of security to keep this type of patient population separate from their current patient population. This bill would essentially open 50 beds throughout the state that would allow a skilled nursing facility to apply for an exemption to the nursing home moratorium and partner with a hospital to serve the patient populations that at times are confined to hospitals for hundreds of days, which is not the appropriate level of care for these patients as it is the most restrictive environment. These skilled nursing facilities would receive double their usual daily reimbursements to serve the patient population. The reason that these facilities will have to do that is for capital improvements and security reasons and to ensure adequate staffing. With me today, I have Dr. Ian Heath with Hennepin County Medical Center, who will talk about the hospital's struggles to find appropriate treatment facilities and how they believe this bill could help HCMC and other hospitals. We also have Jay Paisinger with Augustana Care, a skilled nursing facility which is interested in partnering with HCMC to treat the patient population.
Well, Dr. Heath, welcome to the committee. Present your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to offer testimony today. I am Ian Heath, the Senior Physician Director in the Department of Psychiatry at the Hennepin County Medical Center. Just to put things in context, I'm actually a forensic psychiatrist by training. Worked for the state of Minnesota for 7 years prior to moving to Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm here today to inform the committee of difficulties we're having at the Hennepin County Medical Center due to the lack of bed availability at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which relates both to DHS policy as well as the impact of the 48-hour rule. I want to recognize the difficulties confronting our colleagues at DHS and the challenges they face. As the committee is aware, with the closure of the multiple regional treatment centers, as well as Upper Chain, which was our state nursing home facility, the state put online 10 community behavioral health hospitals. These are bespoke 16-bed new construction facilities that were built specifically to accommodate the closures of the regional treatment centers. For a number of reasons, CBHHs have not run at capacity. They're unable to handle patients with significant behavioral issues, inclusive of aggression, as well as have limits as to the patients they can accommodate in terms of the patient's medical complexity. This has resulted essentially in out-of-state areas pushing for patients to be transferred to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. In addition to this, DHS has reduced the number of beds at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center from they're licensed to have 175 beds operational, but currently they run around 100. Temporary dependency beds have also been reduced. As the committee is aware, around 2013, the 48-hour rule was enacted, and this compelled DHS to accept suitably committed individuals who were within jails. At that time, DHS set aside 4 beds to accommodate this population. Roughly 5 years later now, I believe that probably the majority of DHS's patients at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center come from jails. As a consequence of all the aforementioned, Hennepin County Medical Center, and I believe this is not solely Hennepin County Medical Center, but rather all metro hospitals, have little access to a bed at Anoka. To put things in context, in 2009, we sent 87 patients to Anoka, decreased to 28 by 2014, and over the last couple of years, we've sent 5 and 6, respectively, per year. Now at Hennepin County Medical Center, we admit, commit, treat, and provisionally discharge more patients committed to the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services than the Commissioner admits to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center over the entirety of a year. Again, we are one metro hospital.
Dr. E, we're up against the clock. If you could be as succinct as possible in your testimony.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
As a consequence, there's a large backup in the system. We are unable to get patients at the right level of care at the right time. One of the big issues that we run into are those individuals who have suffered from a substantial psychiatric disorder but also suffer from a neurodegenerative or dementing condition. Many community-based nursing home facilities are unable to accommodate these people due to their increased rates of aggression. We are looking to partner with Augustana, but this is only one iteration of this. Our idea is not, this is not solely HCMC and Augustana, but looking to collaborate so we can have a more integrated care system, provide care in the right setting, a less restrictive setting in a fiscally prudent fashion. On that note, I'll turn it over to Mr. Pisinger.
Thank you, Dr. Heath. Mr. Pisinger, if you could present your testimony as succinct and briefly as possible. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Jay Pisinger, Regional Director of Campus Operations at Augustana Care Facility. We're directly across the street from HCMC and would like to partner with them on this initiative. We have 2 open units at this time and 22 beds in layaway. We would use these increased funding dollars to increase nursing and nursing assistant staffing ratios to patient ratios above where we're at right now. We'd have specific training for staff for these types of patients, vocational rehab, life skills coach, and relocation specialists on top of security and capital improvements that were previously discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Pisinger. Questions from members for the testifier or the author? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, Representative Schumacher, did we see a bill very similar to this? I'm having deja vu with
Mr. Chair, team. Representative McDonald, you're thinking of the aging subcommittee where this came up.
Yes, of course. Thank you. Talk about aging.
You're showing early signs, excuse me. Now, other member questions? Seeing none, anybody want to testify very quickly, 30 seconds or less, to the bill? That's what my wife gives me at home, 30 seconds.
Mr. Chairman, members,
welcome to the committee. Please present your testimony, Ms. Abner-Holding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sue Abner-Holden, now in Minnesota. I'm sorry, this bill was not on my radar because it was nursing homes, which I don't really look at. But I just want to make sure that we are looking at people who are age 65 or older, because when we did close the institutions back in the 70s, a lot of people actually ended up in nursing homes who were young, and that was inappropriate. And I'm sorry, but I just want to make sure that we're not kind of going back to that, that people are in an age-appropriate environment as well.
Thank you, Ms. Abner-Holden. With that,
Mr. Chair, I do have the A1 amendment. I wanted to have the testimony on the first portion of this because the A1 amendment is a little bit different. It's dealing with nursing homes, but not specifically to this. The A1 amendment I'd like to move.
Okay, Chair Schumacher moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment deals with the swing bed limits days in Minnesota. In the last few years, the Mayo Clinic and other centers throughout the state have reached that 2,000 bed day limit that was agreed upon some 10 years ago, and so both the nursing facilities throughout the state as well as the hospital systems have been trying to negotiate out some solutions to that. They are still in the process. They were hoping for something a little bit more this year, but this is what they're able to come up with for the moment. And so
this has consensus around it be with the stakeholders, and I would ask that the members adopt the amendment.
Okay, any questions, members, on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion passes. The A1 amendment is added to the bill. Chair Schumacher, final thoughts?
I will renew my motion that House File 1115 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services as amended. Finance, as amended.
Chair Schumacher renews his motion to refer the House File 1115 to HHS Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion passes. With that, members, we stand in recess. We have a couple more bills that we need to deal with this evening. At the call of the chair, the committee administrator will send an email 30 minutes before we reconvene. An estimated time would be approximately 6:30 this evening, and we plan to be here in room 220 or in room 200. Thank you, members.
File 1383, Representative Dean moves that House File 1383 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We do not have Representative Zerwas with us at the moment, but we do want to get started. Representative Dean, we have the bill in front of us. Two-year bill.
I move the bill to introduce the changes, please.
Mr. Chairman, members,
welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, and I do have a couple of testifiers here. This bill has been a nice work in progress with the Department of Human Services. So we do have an author's amendment in the packet, H1383A1. But, Mr. Chairman, members, if I could, before you adopt that, in the bill itself, on line 1.10, after some conversation with DHS today, we think it's prudent to reinstate the stricken language, the phrase or congenital, in the bill. And what we would do there is just leave the current definition of traumatic brain injury alone. That definition alone does not necessarily trigger what the action is that we're actually looking for DHS to do. The action we're looking for DHS to do is follows in the A1 amendment. So that's if we could do that, that would help DHS as they prepare the fiscal note for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Walseth. Representative Dean moves an oral amendment that on House File 1383, lines 1.10, that we... How would we...
Delete
section? Okay. That we will delete section 1 from the bill on House File 1383.
Okay.
I will say that once again. Representative Dean moves that an oral amendment to House File 1383 that we strike Section 1. Are there any questions to the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted and Section 1 is stricken.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then we're back to the author's amendment, the H1383A1. And this is the language that actually gets to the effect of what we're trying to do. In Chapter 256B, 093, Subdivision 2, which talks about eligibility, there's a reference to be eligible for, you have to be a medical assistance recipient who have traumatic or certain acquired brain injury, and we're trying to add some very specific language there, including a brain injury acquired by fetal alcohol exposure. And then the other piece is to give directions to the commissioner that they will seek to amend the brain injury waiver to include as eligible persons individuals with an FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And then there's some other tweaks in the A1 amendment to the actual grant language for prevention grants, which is the latter part of the bill. So that's what the A1 amendment would do, and then that gets the bill in the shape that we wanted to present it after working with DHS.
All right, Representative Dean moves the A1 amendment. Are there any additional questions for the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Dean, to your bill as amended, or Mr. Walsa.
Appreciate your support.
All right, you have other testifiers for us this evening?
We do. I know it's getting late here, but folks, we could save some testimony, I think, for Chair Dean's committee, unless you want a couple folks just to talk a little bit more generally what we're trying to accomplish with the bill as presented.
All right. Are there any questions for the bill author? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1383? Seeing none, any other final word, Representative Dean? Appreciate your support. With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 1383 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. And House File 1383 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Representative Dean. A much better fill-in for Representative Zur. Oh. I'm so sorry. That's a complete mistake.
Brutal.
All right, Representative Zurwas, welcome to the committee.
If you want.
I'm going to let Representative Dean move House File 1532 to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Zurwas, we have the bill in front of us. You have an A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. If you can move the A1 amendment, get the bill into shape.
Representative Dean moves the A1 amendment. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Zurwas, to your bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for hearing this bill tonight. House File 1532 is brought to me by the Minnesota Home Care Association. This legislation is a response to a federal mandate that a face-to-face encounter by a qualifying health care provider must be completed for home health care services provided under MA. This is similar to a requirement that has been in place for Medicare. I have with me today Kathy Meserle, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Home Care Association, to help explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Meserle. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Meserle, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Home Care Association. Before I begin my testimony, I'd like to thank Representative Zurwas for bringing this important legislation forward. As Representative Zurwas mentioned, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid CMS issued a final rule to strengthen the integrity of the medical assistance home health services. And as he mentioned, it's required to have a face-to-face encounter with a physician prior to actually rolling out the home care services. It's very similar to a requirement that's also already in place for Medicare beneficiaries. The CMS is allowing flexibility within the individual state regulations as to what would be required for sufficient documentation for the face-to-face encounter. Our association has reviewed the language with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So our association supports this bill and its enactment to fulfill the requirements of CMS that MA face-to-face implementation be put in place in Minnesota by July 1st of 2017. I encourage you to support House File 1532, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Meserle, for your testimony this evening. Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify from the audience on House File 1532? Seeing none, are there questions for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Zurwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing the bill.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 1532, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1532, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Zurwas.
Thanks, guys. Have a great night.
Next up, we have Representative Dean, who I believe will be carrying his own bills.
Do you want to? Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 943 be re-referred to the General Register.
All right, Representative Bean moves that House File 943 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Dean, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 943 is a bill that we passed 2 years ago, and it deals with interagency agreements with the Department of Human Services and other agencies that requires reporting to the legislature, and the bill makes changes to the reporting on interagency agreements and interagency transfers to the chairs and ranking members. It requires that the agencies, DHS and MDH in particular, with the Minshew Board, make available copies of agreements upon request rather than copies that are just sent back to us. It will provide a little better reporting for us on those, and that is the extent of the bill.
All right. And Chair Dean, you have the A1 amendment. Would you like to offer that?
Yep, I'll offer the A1 amendment, and that just clarifies who gets the reports.
All right. Are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Is there anyone who wishes to testify from the audience on House File 943? Why do people get up right when I say? Are there any questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Dean.
Appreciate your support.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 943, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 943 is, the motion prevails, and House File 943, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I would like to move House File 944 be referred to the General Register.
Representative Dean moves that House File 944 be referred to the General Register. We have the bill in front of us. Chair Dean, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill is technical and requires the Revisor's Office to change food support and food stamps to Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the correct acronym SNAP, in all of our statutes, and refer that to the General Register. That's the extent of the bill.
Are there any questions for Chair Dean? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 944?
Can you hear me louder?
Final word, Chair Dean.
I appreciate your support.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 944 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 944 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Chair Dean. And with that, we are adjourned.